Attenzione equipaggio di Fantascientificast. Messaggio prioritario dalla plancia di comando.
Abbiamo una missione e per avviarla abbiamo bisogno di voi.
Quest'anno vogliamo portare Fantascientificast alla candidatura per il Premio Italia 2026, categoria Fancast.
Ma per entrare in gara dobbiamo prima essere segnalati. E a farlo siete voi, i podascoltatori.
La procedura è quella ufficiale. Avete ricevuto una mail con tutte le istruzioni. Controllate i vostri terminali.
Per verificare i requisiti o le regole, trovate tutto su premioitalia.org.
Ogni puntata è un viaggio che facciamo insieme. Fantascienza, treccate, tecnologia, universi da esplorare, con voi.
Oggi vi chiediamo un gesto solo, una segnalazione, un minuto del vostro tempo.
Non lasciateci in orbita prima ancora della partenza.
Segnalate Fantascientificast per il Premio Italia 2026. Voi siete il motore a curvatura. Noi siamo pronti al lancio.
Latitudine Zero, Median Fabric.
The present and the future of content creation.
Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia.
In questo episodio di Fantascientificast proponiamo un panel tematico di Mirror Mirror, libri ai confini della realtà. Ospite d'eccezione è Pepe Rojo, accompagnato da Francesco Verso di Future Fiction. Per l'occasione parliamo dei suoi racconti Rumore Grigio e Conversazioni con Yoni Rey, pubblicati in cartaceo e a fumetti su Future Fiction. Panel registrato il 12 giugno 2025. Podcast realizzato in collaborazione con i Dobloni Edizioni. Buon ascolto!
Insieme.
Sì. Oh, allora il conto alla rovescia era finito, non me ne sono accorta, avete visto, ieri sera le mie tette, oggi il mio sedere, ma va bene così, può andare bene anche così. Voi non avete sentito nulla, fa niente. Allora, questa sera è una sera molto particolare, perché come vedete sono qui, in un posto che è un indefinito spazio del nostro spazio, non è il nostro divano. Sul nostro divano giallo ci sono i nostri due ospiti e poi tra poco vedrete anche un terzo ospite che nel frattempo schiccerà durante l'intervista. Io non vi dico niente, tanto lo sapete già perché da una settimana lo sto a macerare, per cui lo sapete cosa sta per succedere su questo palco questa sera e quindi io lascio la parola alla sigla e ai nostri ospiti che non dirò per sempre, lo scoprirete tra poco. Sigla.
Hello, everybody. I'm Francesco Verso, editor of Future Fiction, and today we are at Covo della Ladra, and I deeply thank Mariana for the hospitality, because we have a very special guest, and it's Pepe Rojo from Mexico. Mm-hmm. I've been waiting. Been waiting many years to meet with Pepe. Pepe was one of the first authors that opened up the world of future fiction, because when we started, we had just writers coming mostly from the Anglosphere. And Pepe is a man of two worlds, and he will tell us more about this. But first, I just want to introduce a little bit this event. It's about the fiction, the short stories that we published over the years of Pepe Rojo, and the adaptation of his stories into comics. And we have also the presence of Axel, that is live sketching for us. This meeting is a pure chance, because a couple of months ago, Pepe told me that he was passing by Milan, and it was just the right moment, because we were publishing Rumore Grigio, Gray Noise, that has been out for the Turin Book Fair. And I really tried to set up this sort of appointment and then kind of interview and conversation with you, because I think it's a unique chance to have you in Europe. It doesn't happen
very often.
Right. So this is like, I would like to start this conversation asking, you know, we all are being grown up with American and English science fiction. We don't know much about what has been going on outside this big bubble. My quest has been really to try to connect to other worlds and to prove over the years that science fiction happens everywhere, and that good, excellent science fiction is part of our community, worldwide community. And although it's not written in English, it's very good anyway, of course. So I would like to ask you what interests you, and why did you start writing science fiction? What gave you this genre in order to tell your stories?
Okay, first of all, gracias, Francesco. Gracias, Mariana. It's very nice to be here. And thanks to all of you who came and to have this conversation bodily, because we've talked with each other online in very science fictional ways. So being here bodily means a lot to me. Okay, so my God, this is last century, but I distinctly remember reading Neuromancer by William Gibson, and hearing him talk about the illegal electronics market in Chiba City, I think.
Chiba, yeah.
And thinking, oh my God, this happens in downtown Mexico. Why is this Canadian writing about something that happens in the third world, and we are not? So that kind of like for me, it was a moment that kind of like it was, oh my God, this is the kind of science fiction we could be doing. We could be doing. I worked a lot with I hate unemployment, and I love unemployment. yes, because when you're not employed, when you don't have a job, you have the time to think about what you want to do. So at that time, Bernardo Fernández Bev, which is kind of like an important science fiction Mexican crime, and Fumetti, science fiction, right? We both were unemployed, and we both wanted to write science fiction. So we got together and said, nobody's publishing science fiction in Mexico. Let's start to publish ourselves. So we were very young. We were 20 something. So we started working together in order to publish some science fiction. So we met other science fiction writers, and we started making a group out of them. And one of the things Bernardo says, I said it, and I think he said it. But it's kind of like science fiction in Mexico will find itself when it goes out of the spaceship and into the subway.
All right.
So it was this kind. Yes, it was kind of like, okay, let's make science fiction with this very cyberpunkish kind of like a feeling that let's make science fiction 15 minutes in the future, because it's already here. You can see it. But at the same time, there was this. I mean, we grew up in the United States in the Anglo science fiction, where yes. as most people at yes. my age grew up with. So it was also kind of like a, so what's different?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that was different was to be very non-optimistic about the narrative of technology that is advertising.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, how does this technology changes when it gets to the third world?
Yes.
Or to the supposed third world. So, yes. so it was this kind of like, okay, so what happens when this technology that everybody's saying is the best thing for humanity, what happens when it crosses the border into Mexico and hits people?
Yep.
So that's kind of like what started us writing in science fiction. And I think it was a very useful tool with which to write science fiction, especially in the 90s, in the late 90s. There was this boom of science fiction written in Mexico, because a lot of people were trying to explore this new language in a context that was well, dystopian. It was
yes.
the third world, it is if such thing exists anymore. So we were trying to map out the possibilities of writing science fiction in Mexico. We knew the generation that was before us,
mm-hmm.
and we also had an idea of how we wanted to get away from them,
mm-hmm.
but also keep some things that we really liked. So we published a magazine called Soup that lasted 5 numbers.
Soup?
S-U-B. Kind of like because science fiction was a sub literature.
Okay, sub. Okay.
But sub also means under, like underground.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we were kind of like punkish at that
yes.
time. So there was this kind of like claiming the prefix as a banner. Yes, mm-hmm. we're sub, and we're proud of it.
Okay.
We're even sub normally. We have to be. So it was a. Beth is also an illustrator,
yes.
a great illustrator, so he had a great taste for artists at that time. So the illustrations in Soup were kind of like first class. And we get to meet and make a group of people, which we became friends and collaborators because of that. So that's kind of like the start.
Okay, so I have so many questions now okay. with this thing. So first, you started with cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
So you said there was a previous generation. They were, in a way, influenced by, let's say, the Golden Age. So there was this kind of cut between the previous generation, maybe thought of some Mexican going to space. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
right? But, of course, the use of cyberpunk is mostly in the sense of criticizing the state of reality,
mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
So I think that that was also your idea of your of mm-hmm. this group of people. Did you call yourself cyberpunk like the American guys, or you had another?
We knew we were cyberpunk. We didn't want to advertise it too much, but we were aware that we were kind of like following that moment.
You know, because one thing, when I talked to James Patrick Kelly
mm-hmm.
some years ago, and I made this sort of same interview,
mm-hmm.
and he told me, you know, he was a little bit on not the core of the cyberpunk, you know, Gibson and Sterling.
Sterling.
Mm-hmm. But he was a little bit on the side, and he told me, you know, Francesco, we were not really punk
mm-hmm.
in the sense that we were American you know, white guys. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There were some people like, you know, Pat Cadigan was the one that was really, you know, not doing very well. But most of the people, most of us were doing fine, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. And he told me that the real cyberpunk was the one that happened in let's say developing countries, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, in South America, mm-hmm, in Asia and in Africa. And mm-hmm, and so it comes from James Patrick Kelly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that was sort of a mission that probably the best, mm-hmm, in the sense of literary and representative kind of cyberpunk is the one that comes from developing countries. Mm-hmm. I think you agree with that.
Well, I hope it is. But at the same time, if you have somebody writing science fiction in the 90s in Mexico, he or she probably comes from a well-off place.
Okay.
Because they know how to read English, they have access to that kind of literature, so that speaks also to kind of like a cultural level. I mean,
an elite.
An elite. Both Bernardo and I kind of like were punkish.
Yeah.
Even not exactly hardcore, at least semi-core.
Yeah.
But there was also kind of like a roughness.
Yes.
Just living in Mexico City in the 90s and in the 80s, there was this kind of like there's always this rough edge. And we were also kind of like exploring a very complex city at a very difficult time, which was rough.
Yeah.
And it's, but then again, there's also this kind of like both of us read in English. So we were probably more punk than James Patrick Kelly, but maybe not that much.
Okay.
I mean, I see Gibson and
different
I see
shades Kelly, of punk.
These different shades of punk. Yes, punk hit in a different way in Mexico. Also. Okay. So we were aware of cyberpunk. We really didn't want to kind of like a. We were also the other writer, Romero Grillo, Great Noise. I was thinking, how can I marry William Gibson with a Spanish writer, which was called is called Ray Loriga, who was writing kind of like a underground, very juvenile novels, okay, which I really really like. So I was thinking, how can I mix these two threads that I'm reading and kind of like find the space of my own,
okay,
through that.
Cool. So the themes of cyberpunk, meaning the manipulation of mm-hmm, the body, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and the media corruption or mm-hmm, the sort of power of corporations, mm-hmm, and all these sort of capitalistic drift, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, affecting the daily life of normal people, normal mm-hmm, workers. That got into your stories.
Of course,
they are mm-hmm, the main structure of your storytelling.
Yes.
So mm-hmm, can you tell us more?
Of course. I think during the 90s, late 80s and 90s, the electronic component of that was kind of like seeping into culture hit the body hard. The violence which the body was receiving all this capacity of being connected with all the world, it was ripping the body apart. I think a lot of the body horror, I think Cronenberg, for example,
yes, which Cronenberg.
There was this feeling of the body being ripped apart and reconfigured, that I think I grabbed onto it a lot. Mm-hmm. It's called what's happening to the body with these new technologies, with labor also. But also with the bodies. So that was kind of like something really important for me. It's kind of like yes, we have these technologies are changing our bodies and we don't know how to deal with it. They're changing our bodies in a radical way, in ways which we are not even expecting. So I was kind of like aware of doing that, of trying to explore what was happening to the bodies. I think we're much more used to this electronic culture now.
Yeah.
So I think it's also very violent to the bodies, to bodies and to
can, can you tell a bit the story of Grey Noise for the people?
It's kind of like a Grey Noise is a story about a very young man who gets a camera implanted implanted, I don't know if that's the right word, in the eye, so he can get a job as a journalist and record live. So his job is going out in the streets and finding something to record, because they pay him according to how many viewers he has. So that's 96, and that's internet economy right now. It's kind of like a, but at that time I was kind of like thinking of, okay, what's going to happen? Because I was studying communication. So I was dealing with cameras. I was dealing with editing equipment. And I was saying, okay, these things are getting into my body. And at some point, they're a work tool. What's going to happen to me when my livelihood depends on being a camera? So Gray Noise is about this guy and how he feels about having a camera in his eyes, in a context where there's this kind of like a disease, this sickness that people go into kind of like a trance, a shock, because one of the hypotheses is they can't deal with this much information. So the story follows these guys around as he kind of like he's not just recording the things he sees, but he's also kind of like provoking them so he can get more money. So he's not just an observer, but he's also an actor in this kind of like a daily reporting of the world that today is kind of like what people do.
Yeah, you have anticipated some trends, I think. Mm-hmm. Like you are not just a viewer, but you are responsible of also the things that are happening. Mm-hmm. In a way. Mm-hmm. So there's there where you finish and the participation starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you responsible of that? I mean,
yes. Mm-hmm. It's not kind of like a. It's not just a thing. It's part of your body. The camera is part of your body now.
So, and you cannot shut it down.
You cannot shut it down. One of the most disturbing things about the story, I think, is that he's always hearing a buzzing because he has a machine in his eyes. So there's always a sound, a zzz, that Axel kind of like drew with letters. There's always a hum that he cannot shut it down. So the machine is always inside of him. So it's hard for me to talk about something that I wrote in the 90s because I can also see myself as a young man trying to deal with the fact that I was trained to work with machines that record the world and transmit it live, and I was trying to deal in my head with what does that make me, where does that leave me, because also it's what we were taught at the school is you don't speak for yourself. You always have a client and you speak for the client. That was the way that they kind of like trained us to go out in the world. So you're a machine that speaks for other people.
Mm-hmm.
But you are still a person. So what happens to that?
I mean, objectivity versus subjectivity.
Objectivity versus subjectivity. Yeah. Yes, of course. And and what happens with a subject that is always connected.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's easier to see it now. At the moment, it was much more.
Oh, yeah. That's why it struck me when I first read it. Uh-huh. It struck me because that was something tough, something really in a different sort of cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I read the conversation with Yoni Rei, mm-hmm. I get the second punch,
mm-hmm.
Because that's even deeper.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very tough story about owning a person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's completely the real. It reminded me of a movie that I saw by Alex Rivera,
The Sleep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so. If you can, talk about that.
Seeing Alex Rivera's movie, which is fun because I met Alex Rivera, and he told me that they released the film in New York, and the next day you could find the pirate version in Mexico, and it was called Matrix 4. The cover was Matrix 4, which was
maybe you should tell a bit the story. It's amazing. It's about people that work, people that sleep and work.
Yes, on the side of the Mexican border, you have these comic factories where these people connect themselves to the internet, and they handle heavy machinery and construction works on the other side of the border, on the United States. So it's kind of like you have the labor, but you don't have the bodies on the, of the migrants on the other side of the border.
Yeah,
it's remote labor.
Remote work, remote labor. So they have the laborers in Mexico, but they don't cross the border.
They don't cross the border, which is closed.
We're getting to the border. But yeah, I wanted you to talk about Yoni Rey, because that's part of the all okay. these, you know, corporations.
Yes,
body, but owning the or at least kind of pretending to have something to say about the body of someone,
mm-hmm,
not
mm-hmm.
just that to even grow like a family.
Mm-hmm. So it's a weird story.
Yeah,
but it's kind of like a I imagine it as kind of like a talk show where they're telling the story of this character who is Yoni Rey, was the first baby owned by a corporation. So ever since he was a baby, he was kind of like an experimental body on which they could try different technology, and they could try different experiments because he didn't have a mother or a father. It was owned by the corporation. So it's kind of like the tragic story told in kind of like this sensational news way about this guy and how these experiments were driving him crazy, and how this guy tried to get a hold of the world or try to make sense, sometimes fighting this technology, sometimes trying to take it farther away, sometimes finding some kind of like spiritual spaces in between this body that does not really belong to him legally. So there's always this fight with his own body as it was crossed with technology, and we see this fight. Sometimes he's a rebel, sometimes he's not. Until he ends up being kind of like a
okay. Don't say
I want no spoilers. Okay.
Uh-huh. But with these two stories, convinced me that I was dealing with a great author.
Thanks a lot, Francesco.
And. I found a lot of stuff that really aligned with my research about how science fiction is deployed, as mm-hmm. science fiction is used as a very powerful tool
mm-hmm.
to tell what's going on in the world,
mm-hmm,
in different
of course.
Parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I managed to find you and a lot of other people is really a testimony of mm-hmm. the fact that we should cross the borders.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
We should tear down all the walls,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and we should mm-hmm. embrace this sort of global community,
mm-hmm.
and enjoy the diversity as our highest richness,
mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm.
telling stories.
Of course. I
remember this picture that struck me so much some years ago. It was the first Trump one, when he was trying to build a wall,
mm-hmm,
and on the two different sides of the border, the kids were putting slides mm-hmm. in between, mm-hmm, and they were playing slides
yes.
mm-hmm. from one the side to the mm-hmm. other of the border, meaning no matter how many mm-hmm. walls you will build, we will always find a way
mm-hmm.
to communicate and to get things from one side to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that you have been working on this also with sort of experiments or social kind of
yes.
So can you tell
okay
us?
Yes, of course. So I was living in Mexico City. I was talking to Axel a while ago. Gray Noise, although it never says so, is located in Mexico City, at least in my mind. A very gray city. In the 90s, in the early 2000s, I moved to the border. My parents were already living on Tijuana, which is on the western border between Mexico and the United States. So I go to live in Tijuana with my two kids. Juanás is also here. And living in a border is kind of like just, I don't know, it's Tijuana and San Diego are probably the only places in the world where the so-called first world and third world rub shoulders. It's kind of like a Europe dilutes into Asia as you go east. And then you have the Mediterranean kind of like having a border,
a buffer between
Africa and Europe. But in Tijuana, they're shoulder to shoulder, they're flesh to flesh. So the contrasts are very, very hard. I mean, you just walk from Mexico into the United States and the infrastructure changes completely and everything is much more expensive. It's kind of like a science fiction portal. you change realities as you cross the border at this very uncomfortable and very violent moment where whenever you cross these troublesome borders, there's a moment where your body ceases to belong to yourself.
Yeah.
And they can do to your body whatever they want if they find it necessary. So it's always kind of like there's this violence, but at the same time there's this contrast that was very it was I could see things in there because it's also I mean when you're talking on the phone electronic culture is when you're talking on the phone. You are not here and you are not there. So electronic culture is also always some kind of border.
Mm.
But but in Tijuana, I was living it physically. It was I'm in both sides of the border at the same time, or yes, because it's very close. So there was this kind of like a, oh my God, what the hell is this? And I was lucky to be working at the Autonomous University of Baja California, the State University of Tijuana, and there was this crazy director who told me, "Do whatever you want." So I got a group of students, and I gave them a lot of Mexican science fiction stories, and I told them, "Choose the best ones, choose the ones you like," and we published them as little books that we were giving away at the city for free. Okay, so these students were kind of like trained to talk about science fiction because they had read old stories in Mexico and kind of like distributing them. So the guys at the cultural center in Tijuana thought, oh my God, this is interesting. Let's print more and give them away at the border crossing where you walk from Tijuana into the United States. And they asked us to do readings of the work there. And we told them, why readings? Let's do something crazy. So for a period of 5 weeks, 6 weeks, we went to the border and we started giving away stories. I had 200 students working on this at the end. So first they wrote stories, short science fiction stories about life in Tijuana in science fiction terms. So they were kind of like thinking about some of the stories are kind of like, what drugs are they going to be selling here in the next 20 years? So another stories were kind of like, what happens if I'm working at a factory with a cyborg arm and my cyborg arm malfunctions? Is there going to be a black market for it? And these are just kind of like tiny stories. And, and the students were reading them to the people who were trying to cross. But then it got weirder because we called on people that were doing theater, were starting theater, and says, what can you do here? So suddenly we had a group of six
actors.
Yes, all of them female. And they were standing there at the border, which is a very contested place. It's a violent place. Kind of like doing this choreography of repetitive movements and people were trying to cross and they were seeing them and then kind of like what are these people doing? What are these crazy people doing? But it was very weird because they were doing these repetitive movements, and the people standing in line to cross were also kind of like walking like these. They were also doing very repetitive movements. So there was this kind of like a crossover, and then we invented the saint. That story has recently been reprinted. We invented the saint from the future, Saint Stella. We created her story, and there was a big discussion in the group because some people said, "Oh, in the future, as science progresses, there will be no."
Attenzione equipaggio di Fantascientificast. Messaggio prioritario dalla plancia di comando.
Abbiamo una missione e per avviarla abbiamo bisogno di voi.
Quest'anno vogliamo portare Fantascientificast alla candidatura per il Premio Italia 2026, categoria Fancast.
Ma per entrare in gara dobbiamo prima essere segnalati e a farlo siete voi, i pod ascoltatori.
La procedura è quella ufficiale. Avete ricevuto una mail con tutte le istruzioni. Controllate i vostri terminali.
Per verificare i requisiti o le regole, trovate tutto su premioitalia.org.
Ogni puntata è un viaggio che facciamo insieme. Fantascienza, treccate, tecnologia, universi da esplorare, con voi.
Oggi vi chiediamo un gesto solo, una segnalazione. Un minuto del vostro tempo.
Non lasciateci in orbita prima ancora della partenza.
Segnalate Fantascientificast per il Premio Italia 2026. Voi siete il motore a curvatura. Noi siamo pronti al lancio.
No need for religion.
Religion?
Yes. Oh. And the other group was kind of like, no, as science progresses, we're not going to understand anything. So we're going to have much more of a need of religion. So we invented a saint from the future to which you pray to for the accidents of technology, but also the miracles of technology. So the running joke was, okay, you're taking fertility drugs because you want to have a kid and you can't, and you grow a third nipple, who you're going to pray to? You're going to pray to Saint Stella. Okay, so the students wrote prayers for her, and they memorized them, and they we paraded, we made a procession for the saints of the future, and they were praying out loud. People started coming to us saying, where can I join your church? Where can we donate? We could be giving out the prayers so they could become like people would pray with us. It was a crazy experience. So we had a how do you call flea market? A swap meet. A market where you say sell all things.
A flea market. So Mercatino delle Pulci.
Delle Pulci?
Pulci.
Also flea.
Yeah.
Okay. We invited art students. So we had kind of like a Pulci Mercatino.
Yeah.
With people selling stuff that they thought would be from the future. So it was kind of like a party in the middle of the border, and the people who are selling stuff there would come and talk to us. We printed a newspaper from the future that said border is closed.
Okay. And we could I'm interested in that. So you gave a false information.
It was fake news.
And what happened?
It was fake news. Yeah. We're giving it away. Students were giving it away. Students were these guys in science fiction stuff. So people could come, people could get it, could start reading, and they could come back to us and tell us at what time, when is this happening? Is it ended? So there was this whole kind of like a experimentation with the things that make up reality and how science fiction can easily change them. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you could be seeing the reality through science fiction glasses, but not inside books or inside movies, but outside in
reality.
In reality. For us, it was kind of like a really complicated experiment, yeah. because we were kind of like seeing the buttoning points of reality and how easily you could manipulate them. So it was kind of like a science fiction in the wild. Oh my God, what happens when science fiction goes out of books, goes out of movies, goes out of video games, and happens at street level? Mm-hmm. And students were very excited that we had 200 students doing stuff. So there was also this kind of like communal experience. And it was very... there are two kinds of futures in the border, because I teach also in the United States and in Mexico. People in the United States see a future. I'm going to have a job.
I'm going to have a kid. I'm going to have a house. I'm going to have a pension.
I'm going to have a pension. But people on Mexico side of the border, it's like, no, I'm studying this and I probably won't get a job, but I'm studying this because I like it. It's almost a fuck the future attitude. And so I'm doing this because I like it. So there are two very different visions of the future.
Yes.
The funny thing is that so almost all of the futures my students were dreaming of were very apocalyptic.
Yeah.
We're kind of like a punkish, cyberpunkish, no future,
yes,
kind of like thing.
Yes.
But at the same time, what we lived through these 3 months was very utopian.
Mm-hmm.
We had lots of fun. We had a kind of like a 50, 60 students gathering together to think about the future. I have never had an office that is so exciting, because my office was open. Students could go there anytime. So when I got to my office, I remember one discussion a lot, because there were people thinking about the future of drugs and the drug market. So what they were thinking were, okay, what about that? Instead of having a drug, they put a gland inside your body and the gland produces the drug. So that's the kind of conversations these guys were having. And I just went in there, kind of like was hearing all these conversations.
Because they don't want to buy it, you know.
You just integrate it into your body. It's kind of like, it's much more efficient. Like, yeah, why inject it or sniff it? So get it inside your body. So that was kind of like a very experimental thing we did that would later be kind of like a streamlined into speculative design, uh-huh, or design fiction. Hmm. But at the time, it was very fun.
Yeah.
It was, I really remember those times with kind of like a really great moment of my life.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I have experimented myself, of course, with the many communities that I've met, mm-hmm, over the years. And I can, you know, tell you it's exactly the same when I for example, read solar punk stories from, mm-hmm, from the developed countries, they, mm-hmm, are hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
This is an emotion that you, mm-hmm, get from security. Knowing that you will be here, so, mm-hmm, that you can, mm-hmm, have hope.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's hope for better weather. Let's hope, mm-hmm, for the future. Mm-hmm. Let's hope for the better, you know, for our the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to people from the Global South, the horizon is not set on hope. Mm-hmm. It's set on desperation.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm,
it's a completely different narrative.
Mm-hmm,
that's,
mm-hmm,
why I think it's important to listen to both
yes,
sides of the border, mm-hmm, both, mm-hmm, sides of the world.
Yes,
in a way.
But it's funny because it's really interesting to see science fiction, which sometimes does not have hope, but there's always this centering on the present.
The centering?
Centering on the present. If maybe we don't have a future, mm-hmm. but we have a present. Mm-hmm. And that focus, I also think it's beautiful. It's kind of like it's my body here, it's my community here, and that, and if we cannot have a future, let's have a present. So it's hopeful in a different way.
Yeah, and a guy, a science fiction writer called John Kessel, mm-hmm. he said that science fiction is mostly about the time when it's set than mm-hmm. the time
it predicts.
Sorry, it's mostly about the time when it's written than mm-hmm. the time when it's set.
I totally agree with that.
And that's true. So mm-hmm. it's more like a lens, sort of mm-hmm. a prism that makes you look at reality mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. through the future.
And it's also kind of a friend of mine who participated in interventions told me this is an exorcism. we are exorcising these horrible futures. But by saying them aloud, by articulating these horrible nightmares, yes. we're performing an exorcism. And that stuck with me because it's like, yes, maybe we're trying to
yeah.
see the future and prevent it. Let's try not to this to work out that way.
Yeah, no, I agree. Chen Chufan, which is an important Chinese science fiction author, said because China is going through these dramatic and impossible changes just in one generation, mm-hmm. and he says that science fiction is exactly a tool to try to have an hold on anxiety, which is this projected techno sort of life, technological mm-hmm. life that the Chinese population is living. So through science fiction, mm-hmm. they kind of work out the anxiety. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It could be. It's a yes. sort of exorcism. That's the way you said it. Cool. So what's the situation now? I mean, you were talking about these experiments. You were talking about your generation, but mm-hmm. how is the scene now? What's Mexican science fiction doing at the moment?
Okay, so I think there was, after my generation started working, there was this kind of like a lapse, kind of like early 2000s
okay.
to 2015, where there was not a lot of science fiction being produced. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly why. Maybe it was not the right tool to understand that moment. A lot of the writers who were writing science fiction from my generation turned to crime, to writing crime, because maybe they thought it was kind of like easy to understand reality through that genre. But now, it's a really interesting time.
Yeah, I mean, I've published Gabriela Damián Miravete,
por supuesto,
and
yes.
I've met Andrea Chapela, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I've come across the work of Lydia Brenda. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they are mostly women.
Yes, of course.
And they're pretty young, so there's a coming generation.
Of course, and it's very interesting because I think that the two most important changes, one is kind of like a science fiction written by Mexican women, which I think is really interesting because it was a voice that was lacking, and it's giving the genre a very different perspective. And the other move is towards indigenous futures.
All right.
Okay. So that's also kind of the solar punk side of it, which I think.
And you have stuff like that?
I mean,
the problem is mm-hmm. the language.
Yes. And I think we're going to have. I think the next 10 years is when that's going to really, really happen. It's looking towards that way. There are many people trying to. There's this distinction, which is a very United States distinction between science fiction and fantasy.
Fantasy, yeah, of course.
There's these realism. People saying, why do we have that division? We have kind of like a very big pre-Columbian tradition, mm-hmm. and we have cell phones. So we are living in that distinction is totally yeah. totally irrelevant. So I think there's people trying to move in that direction. It's kind of like a not just seeing the future, but also kind of like bringing in the past. And I think that's where the really interesting stuff is going to be happening in the next 10 years. Kind of like a women writing science fiction. We still don't have a lot of trans people writing science fiction, right, which I think is going to be interesting. And voices that are more rooted in the indigenous cultures in Mexico, because there's not one, there's many. I think they will be gaining a voice in the next 10 years, and I think that's what's going to happen.
You have such a rich cultural heritage. I mean, I've been to Palenque, mm-hmm. I've been to Chichen Itza.
Yes.
These places are, I mean, apart from the touristic part, but the when you see, I couldn't even mention mm-hmm. the name Teotihuacan.
Teotihuacan.
Mm-hmm. It's so difficult for me to pronounce it. And you realize that there's been, so much planning, designing, mm-hmm. knowledge, wisdom, mm-hmm. That is completely lost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's such a pity, because I think that's so deeply rooted into the identity of,
yes.
I mean, it wasn't even Mexico at that time, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and it's also we tend to think of them, and we are taught, even in Mexico, that they're kind of like dead cultures. And no, there's a whole population of those cultures still living. They have not been the dominating cultures.
Yeah, of course.
They have been subdued in horrible ways, but they are living cultures. And they've been kind of kept apart from education, from prestige, from everything. And now I think things are changing little by little. So we're going to have a lot of voices from these traditions that have not been able to write or to say what they have to say. So at least that's what I'm hoping will happen.
Okay, but
it's going to be interesting.
Okay, but my work is exactly in that direction, preserving the biodiversity mm-hmm. of the future.
Of course.
So when I come across indigenous voices, it's always about the American culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about, with all due respect, of course,
mm-hmm,
it's, but there is not just the Indians of the North America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
there are many more cultures.
Yes, of course.
And the issue is that as long as you do not write in English, mm-hmm. you're invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So the big effort is to get these stories out
mm-hmm.
from the local languages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think I heard some projects in Mexico about this. Maybe even Libya Brenda was doing something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I don't remember. I heard about something. And so that would need some support
mm-hmm.
because it's so hard. And so, I mean, when people talk about marginalized communities, it's about identities, but it's never about languages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's going to take a lot of work because, I mean, even in Mexico, you have Calaca. 30 different languages, not to mention what is called dialects, but they're not available to the majority of Spanish-speaking people. So there's kind of like this, Maya to Spanish, Spanish to English. So the process of translation is slow, but I think it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and it has to happen. Yes,
you think artificial intelligence might help?
Of course. yes, of course.
And I mean, they're working on cell phones. They're working on preserving, threatened languages by preserving these.
And as much as I have a lot of concerns about AI, one of the things that it does beautifully is helping you translate stuff. It's kind of like you can go to the source and kind of like have a conversation with the source in a lot of languages that are slowly getting into that. I think translation and AI is a really interesting way to get there.
I have some friends in Peru and they told me about the Quechua language,
mm-hmm, uh-huh.
which is of course has the same problem and a long tradition, but not many people can translate it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there are people talking about
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So probably we should use these tools for good.
And most people who speak, I have troubles with the term indigenous, but I'm going to use it. Indigenous languages are bilingual, and they speak their language and also speak Spanish. So there's also kind of like a, already a translation work happening with them, and I think that's what's going to happen. I think there are already, I'm thinking about Livia Brenda, of course, here, kind of having an eye and waiting for those things to happen. So, but I think right now it's there's a lot of writing being done in these genres, which I think is going to produce some really great works.
Cool.
I mean, Gaby Damiani is kind of a
she's a wonderful writer. Yes, she's very good.
And we have kind of like the people my generation who are still active in science fiction and fantasy. I'm thinking Chimal, I'm thinking Bernardo Fernandez, Porcayo, are kind of like also doing really interesting stuff right now.
For example, do you know if there is an anthology? I come across something, maybe that's how I found your story.
Mm-hmm.
There was an anthology of Mexican science fiction, and it was...
There was one in the 2000s, like a history of science fiction
in English. That's how I got your story. Mm-hmm. But do you know if there are other things?
No, not that much. It's not people just dropping stories here and there. But I haven't seen that. Right now, there are new writers having discussions about how best to organize.
Mm.
And they're fighting amongst each other. Oh, okay. They're writers.
For example, do you have an award?
No.
That's a magazine?
Lacking online magazines. Just this year, I found these, at least three people saying and voting which were the best science fiction stories written last year, which hadn't happened for more than a decade or two decades. So there are people trying to find this way of, let's read all the stuff and let's vote and let's say what's good and what's not good, which have been lacking for, I'm saying 10 years, but maybe more, maybe 20 years. So there's hopes for that. I see things moving right now that weren't moving 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So that gives me hope.
Okay. If you come across them, send them my way.
I'll send them your way, yes, because I was trying to read through all of them. I couldn't get to all of them. But there were some really cool stories. It was like, oh my God, yes, this is interesting. And this is also interesting. So things are moving again.
Okay.
I'm hopeful about that.
That's good. And are you working on
it's fiction? Not exactly fiction. One of the things I had to do for survival during the last 7 years is getting enrolled in a PhD program. So one of the things I was doing was using science fiction and science fiction theory as a tool for critical examining of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the whole thing is cognitive estrangement, at least that's what theorists say, why use cognitive estrangement just for fiction? Why not use cognitive estrangement as a way of dealing with the world?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's very strange to be using a cell phone. It's very strange to have a machine translating your stories.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the work I've been doing, which is very science fictional, although it's not geared towards fiction. I've been working with guys on kind of like a speculative design things, and there's some kind of really interesting projects that I kind of like I want to expand on.
All right. I would like to know more. So
I'll send it your way. Yes. A new anthology of my short stories, because I also wrote a lot of horror stories during the time. A new a collection of those stories will be coming out later this year.
Oh.
I will be sending it to you.
Okay.
It's been interesting to find them all collected in one place.
And of course, the question is, do you write in Spanish or in English?
Now I write in both.
What do you mean in both?
Sometimes I write in English. For this collection, I had to translate a story I had written in English. I had to translate it to Spanish. So it was really, really weird. But right now, I write in both languages.
Okay.
That very border thing to do.
What is your preferred language?
When I sit down, there are some ideas that come across better in Spanish and some ideas that come better in English. And I sometimes find myself starting a sentence in Spanish and finishing it in English, which I like. which I like. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't know. Spanish is in my heart.
Yeah.
English is in my head. Okay. So it depends on what I'm writing.
All right. Okay. Good. Okay. I don't know if there are questions for Pepe. I kind of, or we can.
What about
okay?
Mix of two languages in same
Spanglish.
Same novel in the same short story. Minority dialogue between two words that not communicate, but they must find a way to communicate beyond the languages.
People who have been living their whole life in Tijuana, they speak and write that way. For me, it's still difficult. Not science fiction, but there was a guy who passed away 10 years ago, Rafa Saavedra, for example. He could do the code switching. And whenever I find myself doing that code switching, I always think, oh, it's not as good as Rafa. Because he was the master of it. So I think this is happening in Tijuana already. Maybe not just in science fiction yet, but I think it's going to be pretty interesting. The other side of it is Chicano science fiction.
Oh,
okay, which is it's kind of like doing that, but much more English based.
Okay,
so they use the Spanish as the sprinkle. Okay, so yeah, there's this uneven relationship between languages.
Okay.
He remembers the Cosmic Bandidos.
Okay. Who wrote that one?
I don't remember. It's a novel about not exactly science fiction. It's about science, but it tells about a very kind of people which travels about Mexico, United States, and other countries.
Bad guys.
Bad guys.
Banditos.
And mixed with the quantum mechanics a world in the which the rules of quantum mechanics are permanent, present to the characters. They lives about quantum mechanics, the rules, following the rules of quantum mechanics in the social
relationships.
Strange novel. It's a very strange novel, and I imagine it's that in two different languages. But I read in Italian, and often they have the short phrases in Spanish.
In Spanish.
But
Alan Weisbecker.
Alan Weisbecker. I had not heard about it. It's funny because this mixture of language always send these kind of things to the experimental side, also, which is kind of like also. I don't know if it's problematic, but at least to the United States market, those things sound experimental because they're bringing in Spanish.
It became like a big case regardless of the author. Cool. But that started this idea. What's the relationship between Chicanos and the Mexican? I mean, now the situation is kind of complicated in the sense that we see Mexican flag in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles was created by the Mexican people. California was so Mexican region. So. There is what's the relationship between the people that live there for many generations and the people that, you know, are not there, maybe would like to be there or...
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's also right now,
yeah,
everybody says we're Mexican. Yeah. It's kind of like it's a moment where the small struggles, which, because there's a difference between Chicanos and Mexicans, and both of them kind of like uphold them sometimes in very petty ways. Mm-hmm. But right now it's a moment where people are saying, oh yes, we're together in this fight, which I think is going to be useful, at least in the short term, mm-hmm. but there's always a friction between the Chicano and the Mexicans, because because the access you have to everything on one side of the border mm-hmm. is different to the access you have. For example, right now, the gentrification that's yeah. happening here, it's happening there because people in the United States, because it's so expensive there, are moving to Tijuana. And they're gentrifying Tijuana. So Tijuana has become very expensive because you have these people,
but they are Chicanos or Americans?
They're Chicanos, they are Mexican Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
And they speak Spanish, they look Mexican,
yeah.
but they're driving prices up. So people in Tijuana are also kind of like, oh my God, these are America, these are from the United States, not from Mexico. So there's always this kind
of tension. But I read this news. I mean, Mexico said, please don't come here yes. because you are making the price skyrocketing yes. and we don't want you, so yes. just stay in the U.S.
Yes, yes.
So reality is like
yes,
becoming
it's
so
very
weird.
Complex. It's very complex because it's it's xenophobic in an economic way.
Oh,
it's
yeah. kind of,
yes, you're the money you have is making me have to live in another part of the city while yeah. you come here. The gentrification process, but it's a cross border.
No, so but the idea, you know, that first you were rejecting the poor people, mm-hmm. right? Now mm-hmm. you are rejecting the rich people because yes. they're causing problems mm-hmm. to the inflation rate and housing.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
So it's getting really weird. Really
yes.
Weird.
Yes, it's getting yeah. really weird. It's yeah. always been
weird. Well, we are there.
It's weird in a different historical moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's always very interesting to see. It's a border like that moves so fast, uh-huh. and the future appears in such different ways that, for me as a writer, it's always kind of like okay, I have to be thinking about all of these things.
Yeah. Okay. So, if there are no other questions, I think. I really thank you very much.
No, thank you, Francesco.
And I thank Axel for the sketching. And thank you. I really want to see what you've been doing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And thank you for listening to us. And
thanks.
I hope you will mm-hmm. appreciate the story.
And I hope the language barrier wasn't that bad.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia, è un podcast originale Latitudine Zero, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafini, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof. Massimo De Santo, realizzato da Latitudine Zero, Median Fabric. Showrunner Omar Serafini. Sound design Fabio Marchionni e Julian Ziegler. Post-produzione Gismar Boom. Creative producer Annalise Haas e Valentina Folkov. Coordinamento e promozione Veruska Sabucco. La voce di Val 9000 è di Valeria Barbera. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.com, sul profilo Instagram Fantascientificast, sul canale Telegram Fantascientificast e sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity oppure scrivendoci all'indirizzo email redazione@fantascientificast.com. Tutti gli episodi sono disponibili gratuitamente sul nostro sito e su tutti i principali servizi di streaming on demand. Se volete sostenere il nostro progetto offrendoci una birra rumulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, troverete tutte le informazioni e modalità nell'apposita sezione del nostro sito. Il podcast non intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Val 9000 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento al prossimo episodio lungo la rotta di Kessel. E ricordate, la fantascienza finge di guardare dentro il futuro, ma in realtà guarda il riflesso della verità che è davanti a noi. Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia. Latitudine zero, Nitian Fabric.
The present and the future of content creation.
Attenzione equipaggio di Fantascientificast. Messaggio prioritario dalla plancia di comando.
Abbiamo una missione e per avviarla abbiamo bisogno di voi.
Quest'anno vogliamo portare Fantascientificast alla candidatura per il Premio Italia 2026, categoria Fancast.
Ma per entrare in gara dobbiamo prima essere segnalati e a farlo siete voi, i pod ascoltatori.
La procedura è quella ufficiale. Avete ricevuto una mail con tutte le istruzioni. Controllate i vostri terminali.
Per verificare i requisiti o le regole, provate tutto su premioitalia.org.
Ogni puntata è un viaggio che facciamo insieme. Fantascienza, treccate, tecnologia, universi da esplorare, con voi.
Oggi vi chiediamo un gesto solo, una segnalazione. Un minuto del vostro tempo.
Non lasciateci in orbita prima ancora della partenza.
Segnalate Fantascientificast per il Premio Italia 2026. Voi siete il motore a curvatura. Noi siamo pronti al lancio.